This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCree. A mass shooting at a Virginia park. People tossing around baseballs. The victims, members of a baseball team, may have been targeted specifically because of who they are. Republican members of Congress.
When I was up to bat, heard a loud noise, what I thought was a construction site dropping a loud piece of metal. And the next thing I heard was, run, he's got a gun.
Hear about the 50th anniversary of a flying club based at the Central Illinois Regional Airport. They've been teaching people to pilot airplanes since the 1960s. And GLT's Judy Valente reports on Gwendolyn Brooks, the poet and first African-American winner of the Pulitzer Prize, would have been 100 years old this month. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 14th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The suspect in a mass shooting targeting congressional Republicans has died. Nearly a half dozen were shot during the incident, and GLT's Charlie Schlenker is in the studio with reaction from Illinois Congressman Rodney Davis, who was there when dozens of shots were fired. Charlie?
Davis was not hurt during the shooting. The wounded are in good condition. GLT Washington correspondent Hannah Gutman talked with Davis and sent us this audio. Davis plays catcher for the GOP team. This will be his fifth year playing.
When I was up to bat, heard a loud noise, what I thought was a construction site dropping a loud piece of metal. And the next thing I heard was, run, he's got a gun. I ran into the dugout, dove in on top of others who had made it there before me, and realized that wasn't the best place, and dispersed out for more secure areas and witnessed something I never thought I'd witness, going to a baseball practice for a game we do for charity.
Davis said he and other members of Congress fled the dugout. Shots were fired. They took shelter behind cars and then ran to a nearby apartment building to call police. Davis says time just seemed to slow down.
I felt like it was an hour when you're running away from gunfire and also trying to make sure that your situational awareness is there, too.
Davis credits U.S. Capitol Police officers who were escorting House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who was shot in the hip. He says, had those officers not been there, it would have been a massacre.
The true heroes of this event are the two Capitol Police that were part of Steve Scalise's details. If they would not have been there, this would have been a massacre of major proportions of innocent people in a park where innocent civilians walk their dogs. We have kids at practices. These two policemen, two brave officers, engaged with the shooter. I know one at least got shot herself. And they're the true heroes. They're the ones that made sure that every member of Congress and every staffer is still alive today.
Police have not said whether the shooter was intentionally targeting members of Congress, but Republican Representative Jeff Duncan says he suspects he spoke with the man who minutes later opened fire at the baseball practice. Duncan is from South Carolina. He says he gave a description of the man to Alexandria police that fits the picture that's being shown on TV. Duncan says he was preparing to leave the practice when the man approached him and asked, "Excuse me, sir, who's practicing today? Democrats or Republicans?" Duncan said he replied it was the Republican team, and the man thanked him and turned around. Nothing about the man, Duncan said, struck him as being out of the ordinary. Congressman Davis says, "I don't think it's a coincidence that no bullets were fired outside the baseball field."
I have just as many friends on the Democrat side of the aisle. The majority of what we do in Washington is bipartisan. But the disagreements over major policy issues are what make America great. But it's the political hate and the rhetoric that we've seen that's ratcheted up that has got to stop.
Davis was interviewed still in his baseball T-shirt with blood on his elbow and hand. A government official said the suspect in the shooting has been identified as an Illinois man named James T. Hodgkinson of Belleville. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders says Hodgkinson was apparently at one time a volunteer for the Sanders campaign. Sanders says he is sickened by the despicable incident, and Davis is calling for the shooting to provide a cautionary example to everyone who was politically involved.
We have to come together as Americans. We have to take this tragedy that we saw today, that could have been much, much worse, and turn it into a positive to let Americans know, if you disagree with your leaders politically, that's okay. That's why we have elections. But let's not ratchet up the hateful speech. We see stories about policies are going to lead to the death of people. That's political rhetoric that has run amok and has turned into hate. And it may be the reason why we saw the senseless tragedy that we saw today.
Congressman Darren LaHood of Dunlap was not at the practice, though he has played in the past. Congressman John Shimkus has played in the past, but was also not present. Shimkus' housemate in Washington, however, is GOP Majority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who was shot in the hip. An article in Roll Call magazine several years ago noted that Scalise agreed to let Shimkus room with him on the condition that he play on the House baseball team. Statements of support are coming in from across the aisle, and Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois says, "Our hearts go out to the victims of the tragic shooting. We owe an enormous debt of gratitude to the U.S. Capitol Police who put their lives on the line." The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says it is examining two weapons involved in the shooting at the baseball practice. The agency said it's working to quickly trace a rifle and handgun to determine if they were purchased, where they were purchased. I'm Charlie Schlenker, WGLT News.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Coming up, a report on the anniversary of the Crosswinds Flying Club teaching people to fly for nearly five decades in central Illinois. I'm Mike McCurdy. State lawmakers were unable to get a budget deal, but there was an agreement on a plan designed to combat what's known as gender pay gap. IPR reporter Daisy Contreras examined the issue earlier this year for Illinois Issues, and she joined Sean Crawford to provide an update.
House Bill 2462, also known as the Equal Pay Act bill, is a measure that would prohibit employers from asking job applicants about their wage history, and it passed both the Senate and the House. The argument is that women in Illinois make about 80 cents for every dollar that a man makes, regardless of occupation or educational level. Proponents of the bill, such as Democratic Representative Anna Moeller of Elgin, who sponsored the measure, say that asking about previous wage history only continues this wage inequity.
Any employer who's hiring someone knows what their budget is. They can do their own market analysis, or they can go online and they can ask questions about what the applicant's experience or training or education is like. They can even ask an applicant what he or she wants to earn. They just can't ask what the person's earned before.
And in the Senate, Democrat Daniel Biss was a sponsor of the bill. He argued a very similar point where discrimination based on wage history could be an issue addressed by the bill.
So if you've ever in the past worked for an employer that did discriminate, then that lower wage that you got because of that discrimination will follow you from employer to employer to employer to places that don't discriminate.
The bill passed both the House and the Senate, and originally, as the bill was introduced, there was only partisan support for the bill. Democrats were supporting the measure. When I first started research for this story, though, the bill's sponsor had stated her intent to make this a bipartisan issue. And by the time that votes were taken in each chamber, several Republicans were also on board.
This is a national issue as well when it comes to pay inequity. It's gotten attention even during the last campaign.
Yes. So the national average for the gender wage gap is 80 cents on the dollar, the same as the Illinois average. And according to some experts on the issue, there is very little change year to year. And both at the state and the federal level, there are laws that prohibit employers from paying different wages to men and women when they are doing the same work. However, pay inequity for similar work still persists.
What have been some of the arguments against this measure?
Yeah, so some legislators, especially those with business backgrounds, have argued that wage history was important for them to determine a future employee's capabilities. Republican Senator Chuck Weaver of Peoria was an opponent to the bill.
I think past wages are the best indicator of future performance. If a person's come to me and they've been making $100,000 after working up through a company for 15 years and they changed jobs and made $110,000 elsewhere, that's a very good indication to me of future performance. And my inability to ask about that person's pay history is taking away one of the best abilities I have to determine whether I can afford to hire that person.
That's Senator Chuck Weaver. What do some of the supporters, proponents have to say about this?
Proponents like Melissa Josephs, she is the director of equal opportunity policy at Women Employed, which is a 40-year-old Chicago-based organization that addresses women's barriers in employment and education. She says that salary history is not necessary and that there are other ways to measure a job applicant's performance. This is what she said.
If employers are basing future compensation off of prior compensation, you're bringing that inequity along with you your entire career.
We mentioned that this is now passed. How would this be implemented if the governor agrees to sign it into law?
That's a good question. So another opponent to this bill back when I first wrote this story was the Illinois Department of Labor. Their issue with the bill was the cost to implement the law if it becomes law. According to the Labor Department, they would need to hire additional staff to oversee that employers are complying, especially if complaints are being filed. However, Melissa Josephs from Women Employed says that it would probably be rare for many complaints to be filed. The process of filing complaints to the Department of Labor is a costly one and a long one. She says that the idea behind this equal pay bill is not to get employers into trouble, and her organization plans to hold workshops to let employers know about this new law. So implementation will be more about educating the public.
In your story, you also made a connection between the gender wage inequity, the minimum wage, and women in poverty.
Yeah, so 60% of the state's minimum wage workers are women. Experts on the issue say that the current minimum wage does not allow women already in poverty to get out of that. The rate of women in Illinois living at or below poverty is about 14%. And gender wage inequity also contributes to a woman's inability to get out of poverty. It's interesting because this legislative session, both chambers also passed the minimum wage bill, which would gradually increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour over 5 years. And supporters of the Equal Pay Act and the minimum wage bills, both, they say that they will be a good starting point to help women and their families lead better lives.
Daisy Contreras with an update on a legislative effort to reduce the gender pay gap. She spoke with IPR's Sean Crawford. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. 50 years is a long time for any institution to be around, let alone one that has a high expense and requirements for sustained expertise. But the Crosswinds Flying Club is celebrating that half-century mark this weekend at the Central Illinois Regional Airport. The club was organized in 1967 by Bill Weiss, a flight instructor and pilot for Ozark Airlines. Bill and his peers wanted to make safe, affordable flying accessible to the community. Crosswinds started with a single Piper Cherokee 140, and now boasts a fleet of 4 Piper airplanes, including a Warrior, 2 Dakotas, and an Arrow that flew over 900 hours in 2016. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with the club's Brian Ahrens about how the club has changed since the 1960s.
You know, over the years, we've updated planes, we've increased the membership, and really the organization has just gotten a little bit more professional and a little bit more organized.
So. How so? What's been happening with it?
We've got a set of bylaws. We've got really sort of a board of directors that handles all the day-to-day operations of the club. If anyone has maintenance issues with the plane, the board members take care of that. They're the one who collects all the dues, decide what preventative maintenance and things need to be done to the plane. They organize the online scheduler that the members go on to schedule the planes.
What's its purpose?
Really just to allow people who love aviation and love flying access to safe planes at a very cost-effective price.
How many people have come through the club over the decades?
Well, currently we've got 28 members. I've been a member of the club for 3 years. We've had anywhere from the high 20s to the low 30s of members, but if I were to estimate, I would say hundreds of different people have come through the club and been members of the club.
What do you love about flying?
Well, it just sort of gives you the freedom to go anywhere and see places, whether it's different cities and towns, see them from a different perspective. A lot of people are used to driving into a city and sort of seeing it from that viewpoint. But when you're flying into a city or flying into a location, you see it from a totally different vantage point. So I really enjoy the travel aspect of it. And it really just gives you sort of a sense of freedom.
How long did it take you to learn to fly well?
That's a good question. I would say that any good pilot would say that they're always learning. I started flying when I was 18, and now I'm in my early 30s, so I've been flying for almost 15 years. Yeah, in those first couple of years, the learning curve was a little bit steeper, but constantly learning.
How fast are planes changing today for small craft pilots and for general aviation?
They're changing pretty quickly. The government's come out with some regulations that involve some of the electronics that go into the planes that need to be changed, and those changes need to go into effect over the next couple of years. So the planes are changing rapidly, and like with anything else, it's really all about the technology. The mechanics of the airplanes are a lot the same that they were 30 years ago, but the technology, the GPS, and some of the applications that we use as pilots are changing very rapidly. When I started flying about 15 years ago, GPS was sort of just in its infancy, and now all of our planes have GPS, and that's really the main navigation that we use.
How difficult is it to stay current? How much time does it take, and how much of your own work and how much of it is handed to you by the government or central repositories?
Yeah, so the government and their regulations on general aviation pilots are actually not that stringent. Most of the currency requirements focus on if myself as a pilot was going to take other people with me. That's where most of the regulations come from. But a lot of us have what we call personal minimums, hours that we like to put in per month or per year to sort of stay current in our minds. And most of the pilots in our club are flying, 3 to 4 hours a month, anywhere from 40 to 60 hours a year. And that's for general aviation pilots, that's pretty much across the board.
How expensive is flying?
Flying can be very expensive. But what I like about Crosswinds is when I came back to this area, I looked around at a lot of different options, buying a plane, buying a share of a plane with other people. And through word of mouth and just being in the Bloomington Normal area, I heard about Crosswinds. It was just the most cost-effective option. We've got a lot of different rates, but basically there's an upfront fee when you join the club, and then there's a monthly due that you have to pay. And what I really like about Crosswinds is a majority of that monthly due goes directly to your flight hours. So the club itself, to maintain the club, doesn't take that much of that due. Most of it, you're paying for your own flying time.
How often do you have to buy a new plane for the club or update the current ones?
We actually just bought a plane about 4 months ago. We bought an Aero, and one of the interesting things about it is it has retractable gear. The other three planes that we have don't have retractable gear, and the fact that the one plane has retractable gear allows the members to actually get commercial certifications, which is something that we couldn't get with the other three planes, which is nice. Before that plane, I think it was about 10 years ago that we bought our previous plane. If you maintain the planes, you can keep them for quite a while. And most of our planes were manufactured in the 1970s. And that's also something you'll see sort of across general aviation. A lot of the planes that are being flown today were manufactured in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
When will that technology age out, and when will the new generation of planes become more common?
You know, I really don't know when the current technologies are going to age out. Mechanically, all these planes go through an annual inspection and a 100-hour inspection in which anything that's wrong with the planes is immediately fixed. So you've got aircraft from the 40s and 50s that are still flying strong today. There's really no limit that's been set by the government or the manufacturers as a cutoff date. And these planes, I talked a little bit about technology, these planes have gone through a lot of technology upgrades since they were manufactured. So you can really add technology onto the old mechanical platforms and fly them into the future.
Flying in Europe is a lot more expensive and a lot more regulated than it is in the U.S., and consequently, fewer private people do it. What are the trends in this country?
I think the trends are actually going the opposite direction of what you're talking about in Europe. We've got a great pilots organization here in the United States, and I believe they extend worldwide, but through the AOPA. And the AOPA is a great advocate for private pilots. And they're doing, they're always trying to think of ways to encourage more people to fly.
Would you share a couple of stories of the history of the Flying Club that might be fun for our listeners?
Sure. One person in particular, and this is why I like events like this, events like the 50th anniversary of Crosswinds, is because myself as a member, like I said, I've been a member for 3 years, and you know, I didn't know some of these stories until I started talking to members, and they started bringing these up to me. But one of the most interesting stories is about Ethel Scheffler, and she was a member of Crosswinds Flying Club as an instructor. We've got instructors as members as well, and she's just a very interesting story. She's part of the greatest generation, as it's been coined, and she got her start in flying in the Women Air Force Service Pilots Organization. And they took part in ferrying planes from one airport to another during the war effort. And she was part of that in 1942 through 1944. And after she got done with that, she stayed in flying. And when the club became a club in 67, she actually joined the club as an instructor. And there are multiple people who have gone through the club who have her signature written down, allowing them to get their private pilot's license. And those are the type of memories and the type of good things that the club's doing, you know, for those people and for those for the community. Because I know myself that you know, my memories from flying, they're always with me.
When I was a boy, I read Popular Science magazine, and it seemed like every year there was at least one article dealing with a flying car and how it was soon to come.
Yeah.
And now I read Wired magazine, and it seems like every couple years there's an article about the flying car and how it's soon to come.
Yeah.
What's really going to happen?
In my humble opinion, I think that's pretty far off. You know, cars have their place in society. Planes have their place in society. You know, I just don't know. And we talked a little bit before about infrastructure. I just don't know if the infrastructure is there for people to, say, take off in their flying car and land at Corporate South.
Brian Ahrens of the Crosswinds Flying Club says he thinks the club is well positioned for the next 50 years. Ahrens spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. See pictures of the club and its planes at WGLT.org. It's Frank Sinatra on Sound Ideas.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay.
Oh, Blue Eyes on Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Beginning this month and throughout the rest of the year, there are celebrations across Illinois honoring the 100th birthday of poet Gwendolyn Brooks, the first Black American to win a Pulitzer Prize. Brooks spent virtually all of her life in Chicago, a city that still refers to her as Our Miss Brooks. She immortalized the city's South Side in many of her poems. Here's Brooks reading one of her most anthologized works, The Pool Players, Seven at the Golden Shovel.
We real cool, we laugh school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
GLT's Judy Valente spoke with Brooks' daughter, playwright and educator Nora Brooks Blakely, about her mother's life and legacy.
In addition to being the first African-American Pulitzer Prize winner, Gwendolyn Brooks was Illinois' longest-serving poet laureate, a post she held for over 30 years. She was the first African-American poetry consultant to Congress, a post now known as the U.S. Poet Laureate. Her daughter, Nora Brooks Blakely, says her mother kept writing pretty much until the day she died in 2000 at the age of 83.
Her quote is that poetry is life distilled.
Life distilled.
Yes. And so she was doing a lot of distillation. She looked at things very carefully. She observed well. In essence, reported life back to its livers.
In some ways, she was like Emily Dickinson, where she was, you know, she was looking at what was happening outside her window in the streets and the alleyways and the front yards and backyards where she lived.
It's funny you mentioned Emily Dickinson, because Emily Dickinson was one of my mother's favorite poets. So she did that. But she also took in what was happening in the world. She was a devotee of television news, newspapers, magazines. My parents both had an incredible library, and it didn't just sit there. She read from classic books to new works in literature to information on politics and finance. And I think in the 90s or 80s, she did this poem called Patrick Bowie of Cabrini-Green, which was about a real young man who was shot and killed in the Cabrini-Green Project. And when she talks about him and uses the phrase, our interrupted man, that speaks to everything that's happening today. And so when you read that to a teenager today, it means something to them. It there's a resonance there.
She looked at all of this stuff that was happening with a very clear and sharp eye, and yet it was not critical, it was not judgmental, it was compassionate.
It was compassionate, but it wasn't mushy. When you look at a lot of her work, a lot of it is about specific people. And when you look at that, you get a chance to realize just how much she tells you about the world that they lived in just through this one person or these two people, as in The Bean Eaters, the poem itself.
Talk about that poem a little bit for people who are unfamiliar.
It starts out, they eat beans mostly, this old yellow pair. Dinner is a casual affair. Plain chipware on a plain and creaking wood, tin flatware. And you go on and you hear this poem, and you realize that you know far more about these two people than what is on the page.
Your mother herself went through some hard times. Your father was also a poet, Henry Blakely. Is it true that on the day that she got word of the Pulitzer Prize that she'd won the Pulitzer Prize, her electricity was off because they didn't have the money to pay their bill.
It's absolutely true. And she didn't want to tell the people who were coming. They came with their reporter notebooks and their cameras and stuff, and they were plugging their cameras in, and she didn't want to tell them that nothing was going to happen. And when they plugged them in, all of their lights came on.
And did that mean someone had paid the bill?
No one ever knows. She never knew. We don't know whether somebody sitting at Con Ed saw the news and said, "Oh my God!" or whether somebody who had heard about it just went ahead and paid the bill. We never knew what happened. It's just one of those little miracles in the world.
What other hardship did she experience personally?
We lived, from the time I was two, we lived in a house, a little small house, that cost them $8,000 when they first bought it. There were many tough times where we were in danger of losing that house. And I was eating far more meals of beans and chicken wings than I necessarily wanted to. And this was before chicken wings became really the expensive popular piece of the chicken.
I want to ask you about something that the poet, the Chicago poet Haki Madhubuti, said about your mother. He was kind of a protege of your mother, and he said her religion was kindness. What do you think he meant by that?
That the phrase that her religion was kindness, I think, just talked about her commitment to helping other people and being there for other people. The stories of writers and other artists that she helped with a kind note, some of whom I've talked to, and they said that they put the notes up on their wall, they framed them. It might have been a check for groceries, or in some cases even rent. It was her willingness to go to readings and be there after the readings until every last person that wanted to talk to her had had a chance to speak with her. It was the Poet Laureate Awards. She created the Poet Laureate Awards. There was no such thing before she became Poet Laureate. There were no responsibilities identified for Poet Laureates. And she was the one who created the awards, and for 31 years?
I think she was the longest running Illinois Poet Laureate, even longer than Carl Sandburg, whom she replaced.
Way longer than Carl Sandburg.
So what
I
was...
I can't remember how many years Carl Sandburg was Poet Laureate, but it was nowhere remotely near 30 years.
What was that experience like for her to be the Poet Laureate of Illinois?
Well, she basically created the experience. When Governor Otto Kerner asked her, one of the questions that she had asked him is, what were the responsibilities of a poet laureate? And I always remember that he told her that her responsibilities would be commensurate with her pay. And there was no pay.
There was no pay.
But she didn't feel comfortable with that, with having a title without something to do, her best gift in that position to the state of Illinois was the Poet Laureate Awards. I mean, nobody had ever thought about doing that, and she has over 30 years of children's writings from kindergarten through 12th grade that might not have ever existed if she did not have that award program.
You mentioned that her poetry, her life, became increasingly political in the 60s and 70s. Why did your mother think poetry was a good vehicle for affecting reform? People don't think of poetry today necessarily as having anything to do with the public discourse.
As her worldview changed, the way that she addressed certain things in her poetry changed, because this was now the truth as she knew it to be. I don't think that there was ever a time that she said, I'm going to sit down and write a political poem.
I have to ask you, do you have a favorite poem of your mother's? And would you be kind enough to read it?
I usually run screaming from that question because my favorites of hers change by the day or the week. But I do know that there's one poem that I've been reading more lately, and it has, and it's always in my top three. As much as I love We Real Cool, I think that, as my mother said, it would be nice if anthologists and others recognized that she had written more than one poem. So certainly one of my favorites, and one that I think more identifies what her message to the world is the poem Paul Robeson. That time we all heard it, cool and clear, cutting across the hot grit of the day. The major voice, the adult voice, forgoing rolling river, forgoing tearful tale of bale and barge and other symptoms of an old defunct. Warning in music words, devout and large, that we are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond.
That's beautiful. We are each other's harvest. Nora Brooks Blakely, it is just a delight to talk with you about your mother, the great American poet, Gwendolyn Brooks. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time and the interest. I really appreciate it.
GLT's Judy Valente talking with Blakely, the daughter of Gwendolyn Brooks. Starting Friday, selected items from the Gwendolyn Brooks Archives housed at the University of Illinois in Urbana will be on display at the Poetry Foundation in Chicago. Also part of the centennial celebration, the Brooks Estate is releasing a new collection of the poet's work called Seasons, a Gwendolyn Brooks Experience. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
For GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Delavan, Illinois native Cody Dekoff, a.k.a. Chicago Farmer, returns to the Castle Theater in downtown Bloomington tomorrow evening, opening for Robert Earl Keen. In September, Dekoff talked about his album, Midwest Side Stories, with GLT's John Norton.
Well, let's just start with the first song on the album. All right, sure. We'll start with Umbrella. Is this an introduction to the album itself? Is this an introduction about you getting into music in the first place?
It kind of is. I would say that music definitely kind of got me out of a hole when I was younger. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. My friends and I had kind of made a habit of going around town and causing trouble and breaking things. I remember my counselor, my parents asked me what I wanted to do after high school in this small town of Delavan, and I said, I don't know. And they said, what do you like to do? And I said, I like to go around town breaking things. And so when I came home one day and told my parents I wanted to be a musician, they were thrilled. They were all about supporting me because I finally wanted to do something. And music has definitely got me out of many holes in my life, and it's kind of been there for me. It's been very therapeutic. This song is kind of definitely about me, but it's also kind of a nod and a tribute to those who came before me, who are songwriters as well.
I arrived here kicking and screaming the day that I took the stage. I went searching for some kind of meaning, like words looking for a page.
You've alluded to being angry in the past when we've had you on GLT, and was it just that you just didn't know what you wanted to do with your life? Was it growing up in a small town and not having a lot of options, a little bit of both?
I think it was something that I needed a release, and I didn't know what that release was. And I played sports, so I kind of had a physical release, but, you know, I had a great childhood. I had awesome parents who were supportive and loving and had the coolest sister and friends you could imagine, but I guess when I finally got the creativity bug, I just ran with it, and I needed more and more of that. And Yeah, I don't think I was angry. I was just kind of lost looking for something to do.
How did you find it?
My friends and I used to skip school, and we would hang out upstairs, and we would listen to some really hard rock and roll and some loud punk rock music.
Give me some examples.
Fugazi, Minor Threat, anything from like that to, you know, Metallica, and the big grunge wave was very popular back then. And we went downstairs one time, and my friend's dad had an old acoustic flat-top National guitar, and he liked to play old Hank Williams songs. And I just, as soon as I heard his voice with just that acoustic guitar playing those songs, it kind of just struck me as, you know, more sound and meaning than all these other bands that were trying to fit all these 8,000 notes into a minute, and they were trying to just, you know, kill my eardrums. It was just the musics and the songs and just that sound of an acoustic guitar and a human voice just kind of spoke to me.
What was it, one of those thunderbolt moments?
I think so. I mean, I didn't know, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna be a folk singer now, but I knew that my tastes had definitely changed just in that kind of instant, and so that was pretty cool.
Midwest Side Stories. Is this sort of a step up for you?
I think so, yeah. My last album was called Back and Forth Illinois, and when I wrote those songs and the years that led up to those songs, I was just traveling from bar to bar, back and forth Illinois, and it seemed like that was my life, from Illinois bar to Illinois bar. And then when that album came out, it kind of put me on the map as a singer-songwriter and a folk musician. And so I've definitely expanded, got my name out there a little bit. We kind of went from Illinois, now we're expanding to the Midwest, and hopefully soon we expand nationwide. But the songs and the stories in this album are definitely, I think they relate to all Midwesterners. So.
Well, they do, and there seems to be a crispness to this album that part of what I was alluding to a step up, that it seems like you've upped your game just a little bit.
Yeah, I think about the songs more. I think about the characters more. I think about the connections more. I'm fortunate to have a manager who has my back in my music, and he tells me that my career is like a slow burn. And I said, if it burns any slower, it might just go out one of these days. So I was like, let's throw some gasoline on this thing. And so I really kind of focused on these songs and just really wanted to put out a full-length album, which is really strong songs and a theme that meant something to me and that could mean something to other people. And I think it came through.
This is to generalize a little bit, but it seems like you've gone from just being an observer to having a point of view as well as being an observer on this album. And you mentioned, you know, you're broadening to the Midwest, but at the same time, I think it's really cool. On one of the songs, you even reference Miller Park here in Bloomington,
yeah,
or the east side versus the west side of town, which, you know, there is a chasm between the two sides of town.
And my wife and I first moved back to Bloomington. We lived on West Olive, which is very different than East Olive. And
I used to live on East Olive.
Yeah.
And I used to go out on the West Olive side.
Yeah. And, you know, my wife and I, we walk our dog through Miller Park every day. And so there's certain character about the West Side and the Miller Park that we love. And I thought that would be a cool little addition to throw in there.
I see you at 6 down in Miller Park. I'll pick you up in my new used car.
I mentioned that you reference the east and west side of town. You're referencing Miller Park. A lot of the songs are have versus have-nots. That's almost a recurring theme in some of these. And you definitely have more of a point of view on this album, I think. It's much more political, and you're very open about that. What got you to go, you know what, I want to let my feelings out a little bit here?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a lot in our world that's kind of crammed down our throats, and if you don't see some of the things that are going on, you're either just not paying attention or you don't care. And I do care, and just things that happen all over the world devastate me, but I think a lot of things that happen, like, so close to home, like in Ferguson, Missouri, you know, I had my family lives right in Troy, Illinois, across the river, and Chicago, who, I, you know, I lived in Chicago for so many years, and to see these tragedies keep happening right here in my backyard, to people in central Illinois who deal with addiction every day and their job losses and their houses ripped down by tornadoes and things like that. When things hit home with you so much, you can't ignore that kind of stuff.
Revolving Door is another song on the album. It's a jab at losing all these manufacturing jobs, and just losing jobs that at one time people got to go out of high school and get a good paying job without having to go to college. Uh-huh. Is this something that you were seeing growing up in Delavan and wanted to move on? Are your friends doing the same thing?
Absolutely. My first real song where I felt like I had a voice was a song called Assembly Line Blues, yeah. which is an old song, and I actually only worked at Caterpillar for a couple days, but I was I only lasted for a few days and went back to my guitar. But
you didn't want any part of it, or they didn't want any part of you?
Both. Yeah. I just wasn't working out. But I was sitting at my hometown bar one time, and to the left of me was a guy who had worked at Caterpillar for the last 35 years. And to the right of me was someone my age who was about to start working at Caterpillar for the next 35 years. And, yeah, it employs, like, I would say, a huge portion of our town, not just here in central Illinois, but manufacturing jobs all over the Midwest, who just kind of say, oh, by the way, you're not working here anymore. And the same thing has happened to my wife, actually. My wife's an online teacher, and just not that long ago, her school just overnight just closed down and was gone. And just the next morning, you know, you go to bed with a job and you wake up the next morning, you don't have one. That unless that really happens to you or somebody you know, you don't really understand how huge of a thing that is, what a weight that can put on somebody.
Farms and Factories is another song on the album. You grew up on a farm.
My entire family was pretty much farmers. I didn't live on the farm, but I lived in the farm town, and I would help my grandpa and my uncles, you know, bale hay, walk beans. I did plenty of time to tasseling and painting barns and digging holes for fence posts and all that kind of stuff.
There's a line in there that really caught my ear. I take their spirit so people can hear it and put it in a song.
Yeah, in the song, it kind of goes through a whole list of what my family does, from teachers to preachers to farmers to my dad and my wife's grandfather, both shoe salesmen. My dad had a whole cobbler business, actually had one back in the day in the College Hills Mall here in Bloomington Normal, and also had a shop in Northwoods Mall in Peoria called Grizzlies, and they used to sell Western wear and cowboy boots and used to fix up shoes and stuff like that. So my family is just a hardworking Midwestern family, you know. A lot of them are farmers. Some of us, like my dad and I, chose a different path, you know, like being a songwriter and stuff. So, but that hardworking Midwestern Illinois spirit just inspires me a lot, and people working their trades and doing their passions and things like that in the family. So
I take the spirit so people can hear it. I put it into a song. In every part, it comes from the heart and has our name put on. My family works in the factory. My family works on the farm. Take pride in the farms and the factories. No pride on the factory farm.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning how you finally found
your role in life, so to speak. You know, mm-hmm. you're an artist, you're a musician. What have you learned about yourself over the years as, you know, you've developed as an artist?
I've learned that I'm not afraid to make a fool of myself on stage, because I do that often. And I still get the butterflies every time I get up there. But it's
every
just,
time?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's
pretty
a good
much.
Thing, though, isn't it?
I guess sometimes if it's a loud bar or something, I'm pretty comfortable. But the other night, I just played a quiet room with 50 people where you could hear a pin drop, and I had the butterflies. And it felt good, actually. Just, you know, I've been doing this for 15 years and still get the butterflies, but I've come a long way, that's for sure. I used to play in a corner of a bar and just play to nobody paying attention for 4 hours, and now I've kind of just developed a thing that's kind of a connection with the audience. And instead of it being two separate entities, me and the audience, we kind of become this one big thing. And I owe a lot of that to my fan base, who's super supportive of me and is willing to get involved into the show and really get involved, you know, mentally and physically and emotionally to the songs and the performance. So that's been huge.
Well, Cody Decoff, a.k.a. Chicago Farmer, great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for your time. And
thanks to GLT for all the support over the years. I'm still here.
Cody Decoff, also known as Chicago Farmer, speaking with GLT's John Norton. His album Midwest Side Stories is the new one. Chicago Farmer plays the Castle Theater in Bloomington tomorrow night, opening for Robert Earl Keen. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the complete show podcast and all the individual interviews at our website, WGLT.org.